Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist of Freedom Estate. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
Hello there, everyone. My name is Preston Washington. I'm your host tonight on the Gist of Freedom, coming to you over www.blackhistoryblog.com. I am a genealogist and historian and the president of the Midwest Afro-American Genealogical Interest Coalition here in Kansas City. If you're ever in the area, drop by the first Saturday of every month at the Bruce R. Watkins Cultural Heritage Center at noon. Our meetings are open to the public. We're going to look at or talk about unsung civil rights heroes tonight. And before there was Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Rosa Parks, etc., there was a gentleman by the name of Edward D. Davis, along with Harry T. Moore and his wife, Robert Saunders, Robert Ruby Hurley, etc. In fact, our guest tonight, again, I want to remind you, this is www.blackhistoryblog.com. Our guest tonight is Chester Sims, who's here to talk about his uncle, Edward D. Davis, who was very instrumental in the civil rights movement in Florida, one of the unsung heroes there. Also joining us later during this conversation will be Mr. Davis's grandson, Daniel Banks, in addition to his widow, Lerone Davis. Are you there, Chester?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Welcome to the program tonight. And
Thank you very much.
And start out by telling us about the what you have going on there in Florida in terms of getting your uncle into the Florida Hall, Civil Rights Hall of Fame.
Last year, the state of Florida passed legislation authorizing the formation of the Florida Civil Rights Hall of Fame, and the first class of inductees of three people were Mrs. Mary McLeod Bethune, Reverend C.K. Steele, and former Senator Claude Pepper. After noticing these inductees, it came to my attention that there were a whole bunch of people, in my estimation, who were in front of Claude Pepper. For those of you who don't know, Claude Pepper was one of those Southern legislators who did sort of a George Wallace turnaround kind of thing. But at any rate, our family took it upon ourselves to get in touch with the Florida State Commission on Human Relations, and in so doing, we sent them a copy of my uncle's book, which is entitled 50 Years for Freedom in the State of Florida. And that was necessary because in that, this covers the period from approximately 1929 to about 1979. And in that book, my uncle lays out all of the efforts and all of the major players who were involved in the liberation struggles of that period.
Excuse me, Chester, are you on a Bluetooth or some other kind of phone?
I'm on an iPhone.
Okay. Got a lot of background noise there.
I'm getting that feedback myself, and I'm near I don't have anything on, no volume on anything, so
okay.
I don't know what that is.
All righty. Well, maybe our engineers will figure it out. But go ahead, continue.
I hope so. So I took it upon myself, as I said, to nominate persons who were truly deserving of this honor. And that was, as you know, Mr. and Mrs. Moore were assassinated on Christmas night of 1951. I was 8 years old, so I remember that period of time. And my uncle was nominated. During his lifetime, this man was born in 1904, and he passed away in 1989. That feedback, Preston, is a little disconcerting there. I don't know.
Yes.
But again, here's the man who dedicated his life, along with many of the people he talks about in his book, toward fighting those first battles to get us out of second-class citizenship. Just to give you a brief background, my uncle, his first wife, and my mother, his sister, were in the college graduation class of 1928 from Payne College in Augusta, Georgia. Now, that's 63 years after the end of slavery. He later became the first African-American in the state of Florida to have a master's degree from Northwestern University in 1934.
Okay.
These people, along with the Moors, these educators, that time in Florida, people with the same qualifications, like me, to be making $50
a month. Wow. Is your grandson on the air yet? I'm hearing some voices.
Daniel, are you here? Daniel? I don't know who that is. He doesn't seem to be on.
Okay, and I hear a small child also.
Me too. There's no one. I'm in my club. I'm here alone.
Okay.
I don't know what that is. Are we still here?
Yeah, we're
yes.
still here. Go
okay.
ahead.
All right. So when my uncle became an educator in the state of Florida, black students would go to school 6 months out of the year, and then they were put out into the fields for the rest of the year. I have in his papers his first demands and requests for a full school term for African-American students. That's one of the battles he fought. As I was saying, black teachers with the same qualifications as whites were making $20 a month, and white teachers were making $50 a month. He fought the battle, took the case to court to win equal pay for black teachers in the state of Florida. While he was, he founded the Florida State Teachers Association, which began what was called the Equalization Movement. Mr. Moore, in another county, became very active in the Equalization Movement. As a matter of fact, he was fired from his job as principal because of his involvement. When you got involved in things like that in the 30s and 40s, my uncle in his book indicates how people were run out of state. They were fired. As a matter of fact, Mrs. Moore lost her job, and it took several years and a move to Palm Beach County for her to be rehired again as a teacher. They, while my uncle was starting the Florida Voters League, Mr. Moore was forming the Progressive Voters League. And between these entities, they registered the first African Americans ever in history to vote in the state of Florida. These efforts ultimately, as I said, cost them all their jobs. As a matter of fact, there's a quote in my uncle's book when he was fired from the principalship of the school in my hometown. The quote was, "You don't need a master's to teach little nigger children." Okay, that was
okay.
What was said to him by the authorities, by the school board. So after being fired, he and Mr. Moore together began to be very active in the NAACP. I have to paint this picture, too, because we're talking about a time, Preston, when, number one, as we all know, there was no Internet, but there was no 24-hour TV. There wasn't even TV. Radio was the only thing we had. There were no, for your listening audiences, you know, there were no Burger Kings and McDonald's and Wendy's and Walmarts and Kmarts. And, you know, this was agrarian America in the 1930s. Okay, they were lucky to be able to afford automobiles. But as my uncle indicates in the book, under Mr. Moore's leadership, the NAACP grew from 5 chapters, I think, to 77 chapters statewide. Imagine that. Here are people who are spending their time on the roads, the rural roads of Florida, organizing and getting people to form branches of the NAACP. And again, this was before there was SNCC and SCLC and the Black Muslims and the Deacons for Defense. The NAACP was all there was at that time. And through their work, and they're filing these federal suits. That's the groundwork that was laid for the work that later civil rights leaders were able to capitalize on.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I also talk about a lady who died in August of 07. Her name at her death was Irene Kirkcaldy. Her maiden name was Irene Morgan. Miss Morgan did, in 1944, what Rosa Parks did in 1955. And nobody knows her name. I think that that's a disgrace. What happened was, Miss Kirkcaldy in the state of Virginia refused to give up her seat on a Greyhound bus
mm-hmm.
in Gloucester, Virginia, and was summarily arrested, etc. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court with Thurgood Marshall, then an NAACP lawyer, as the attorney who appealed that case. That was the first case. And it was, as it states, the High Court held in June of 46 that Virginia law requiring the races to be separated on interstate buses, even making passengers change seats during the journey to maintain separation if the number of passengers changed, was an invalid interference in interstate commerce. This case received little attention. And not all of the companies complied with the ruling, but it paved the way for civil rights victories to come, including Mrs. Parks' stand in 1955. Those are the people like Mrs. Kirkcaldy. There's a lady that my uncle talks about by the name of Ruby Hurley, who was Southern Regional Director of the NAACP covering North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, and Florida. Imagine this, a black woman being over that entire region. And he tells a story of her thankfully having enough gas in her car to to make it to the Georgia state line when she was attending an NAACP meeting in Birmingham, Alabama, and the Alabama legislature outlawed the NAACP. Consequently, she had to run for her life with people chasing her. You know, those are the stories, Preston, that in this little screenplay we did that we're trying to highlight. My uncle was very magnanimous in his dedication of his book. And if you don't mind, I'd just like to read you a slight passage from
his dedication.
It says, to the following persons who gave their lives in our struggle for freedom here in America, and to the hundreds of others, other nameless and unknown victims of America's race prejudice, I dedicate these works. James Chaney, Denise McNair, Addie Mae Collins, Harriet Moore, Vernon Dahmer, Harry T. Moore, Jonathan Daniels, Reverend James Reeb, Medgar Evers, Carol Robertson, Andrew Goodman, Michael Schwerner, Willie Jones Howell, Samuel Shepard, Jimmie Lee Jackson, Cynthia Wesley, Dr. Martin Luther King, Melvin Womack, Paola Louzo, and Willie Benson. That's who he dedicates his book to.
Okay.
The people who paid the ultimate price. Yes, sir.
Yeah, as you mentioned, his involvement with the NAACP. For some of our younger listeners out there, take us back to the Niagara Movement and bring us forward.
Okay, now, that's, what, 1904, I believe? 1900?
Thereabouts, yes.
Yes. The late Walter White and... let me just state also, I am not an academic historian. I'm simply well-versed on that part of it that fringed on my family's involvement.
Okay.
So I don't quite feel qualified to answer the breadth of your question.
Okay.
But,
well, in his book, did he mention the early founding of the NAACP, since he started one of the first chapters there in Florida?
Well, what he does, as a matter of fact, I'm turning exactly to that particular page here where he talks about what he does is outline their legal involvement in several landmark cases in the state of Florida, specifically, and in particular, Justice Marshall's involvement. Justice Marshall himself did two cases, and it was over him in bringing there to deal with that. Oh, please bear with me. I'm flipping pages
okay.
Here it is. After dismissal from the school system, I served two terms as president of the State Conference of NAACP branches. During the first term, the executive secretary of the Florida NAACP branches, Harry T. Moore, and his wife were brutally assassinated. My and the families of other NAACP officers were given police protection. I do recall, however, an incident shortly thereafter where I went out to retrieve the morning newspaper, only to discover that dynamite had been placed near the steps of our house. Upon alerting the officer who had been assigned to protect us from these hazards, his response to me was, quote, "That's what you get for being a troublemaker." Close
okay.
Quote.
Okay. Going back to the Niagara. Go ahead.
Yes. Go right.
Go ahead and back to the. I'm getting back to the Niagara Movement for some of our younger listeners out there. It was the forerunner of the NAACP, founded by W.E.B. Du Bois and Ida Wells, people of that nature. Getting back to the Moore family, Chester, was anyone ever brought to justice on that?
To this date, no. And the implications, Preston, are very strong that it was Sheriff Willis J. McCall of Lake County, Florida, who ultimately was responsible for the assassination of the Moors. Now, I say that, and I'm reading from a document here. You see, Mr. Moore had been pushing for the indictment for murder of Sheriff McCall, okay? And that was because of a case called the Groveland case, where these four young African-American men had been unjustly accused of raping this white woman. One of them ended up being killed almost immediately. And then in Sheriff McCall's custody, the others were shot. And it was called the case, the Groveland Four. And this was July 16th of 1949. Norma Padgett, a 17-year-old Groveland, Florida girl, accused four black men of rape, testifying that she and her husband were attacked when their car stalled on a rural road, etc. So, again, as the rumors spread, you know, people were calling for a lynch mob and all of that. The case, a grand jury indicted the rape suspects. In 1951, the Supreme Court ordered retrial for the two remaining, Shepherd and Irving. In 51, while transporting the prisoners to the state penitentiary from Lake County, McCall was forced to shoot both handcuffed prisoners when they had attempted to escape, quote. Sam Shepherd was killed at the scene. McCall and Irving were both transported to Waterman Hospital in nearby Eustis, Florida, for treatment. The retrial of Irving, after his recovery from the shooting, NAACP lawyer and future Supreme Court justice represented Irving in the case. Harry T. Moore, the executive director of the Florida NAACP at that time, demanded that Sheriff McCall be indicted for murder, and requested that the governor suspend him from his office. 6 weeks after calling for McCall's removal, Moore and his wife were killed when a bomb exploded.
Now, when that bomb exploded, were they the only two in the house? Did they have any children?
Their daughter at the time, Evangeline, was in school at Howard University, headed home for Christmas, and as the trains are always late, her train was late getting there. That's how she managed to stay alive. And I think there was one other girl in the Moore family who was uninjured. But the both parents were killed. And it also happened to be their 25th wedding anniversary.
Now, I heard you say that you're a screenplay writer. Are you going to bring Mr. Davis's story to the big screen?
What I have done is written an adaptation of his book in hopes of doing that, Preston. That's what we're working very hard to try to do, to tell this story in a very comprehensive manner. But something, because you're a journalist, here's something I really like to point out that my uncle does in his book. He devotes a great bit to the role of the black press in keeping and the struggle alive and in fostering the struggle. When I was born, Preston, let's say 1951, for instance, that same year that the Moors were assassinated, it was my first year in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. As a fourth grader at the time, of course, we had learned to read. We'd had our little weekly readers. But black news in the major Fort Lauderdale paper on the back cover of the Friday paper was what was called colored news. Okay? That's from your major organ. So if it weren't for the Pittsburgh Courier, Atlanta Daily Word, and several of these other black newspapers, our stories and our fight wouldn't have been able to survive. Here's what my uncle says about that. The black press was born of desperate necessity, born to advocacy and developed through dissent and conflict. And he gives even a history. It was March of 1827 when John B. Rushworm, a graduate of Bowdoin College, and Reverend Samuel E. Cornish, a Presbyterian minister who had attended Princeton, started Freedom's Journal in New York City, published from their headquarters at No. 5 Barrack Street. They contended that it was time for the black man to speak for himself. Too long have others spoken for him, end quote. And so that he cites that as the beginning of the black press, and then he talks about the role of the black press in Florida was first that of being a protest organ, fighting mm-hmm. for the equality, fighting for the equality and equal opportunity for blacks. Next was that of being an instructive media for the same. By its nature, the black press was militant, thereby serving as a monitor for the black leadership who might tend to sway away from the goals and objectives of the disadvantaged black group. The leadership group, including teachers, was leery of the black confrontation with the press. And then he goes on to mention individual members, journalists, such as Mr. H.E. Sigismund Reeves, who started what is called the Miami Times. And he talks about Mr. Reeves and his life. Then he talks about C. Blythe Andrews, where he mentions that who started what's known as the Florida Sentinel, which was the oldest black newspaper in the state. And he says, when I came to Florida in 1928, the person who was editor was a young journalist by the name of C. Blythe Andrews. I knew C. Blythe when he was in college at Atlanta University. He was the star catcher of the university baseball team. After leaving college, C. Blythe went to Chicago, where he joined the staff of a black weekly. His talent was quickly recognized. If there's such a thing as a natural writer, C. Blythe is very close to it. And he goes on, his column, so they tell me, delighted thousands of Floridians over four or five decades. Then he mentions a Dr. Von D. Mizell, who was a Morehouse grad. I'm a Morehouse grad. And Dr. Mizell was one of our first two black physicians in Fort Lauderdale. Dr. Mizell also started the local branch of the NAACP, and his newspaper, which was called the, it escapes me at the moment, but Dr. Mizell also was the man who, after my freshman year at Morehouse, when I had the blessed fortune to march on the first march with Dr. King on downtown Atlanta, which also was my last march after those people spat on me and axe handles and water hoses and dogs and all that nonsense, we go back home and Dr. Mizell was leading the march, and Mrs. Johnson, Eula Johnson in Fort Lauderdale, were leading our march to protest the segregation of our municipal beaches there in Fort Lauderdale. So he talks about Dr. Mizell. Then he talks about a Dr. M.D. Potter, who started the Tampa Bulletin. And then he goes on and on. Something you might appreciate. Talk about the power of the press. He talks okay. about there's a lynch mob and what a significant role that last man I mentioned, Dr. Potter, had played and the kind of respect he had garnered. He said, in a small town in this state a few years ago, some colored people, that's what we were called then, were returning from church by way of the highway. A carload of whites who had apparently been drinking came and yelled at the colored pedestrians, who in turn yelled back. the whites brought their car to a stop and jumped out. Then, with guns drawn, they proceeded to beat up the party of blacks. One man escaped to his nearby home and soon returned with his shotgun to find one of the whites holding his wife on the ground and another in the process of jumping up and down on her stomach. The Negro shot and killed the man doing the jumping. The others ran. The Negro gave himself up to the sheriff. After much talk about lynching, the trial came off. A jury brought in a verdict of not guilty for the Negro. But because of the threat of lynching, the judge deferred the announcement of the verdict and locked the jury up overnight. He then got in touch with Dr. Potter by way of long-distance telephone, who immediately traveled alone to this town some 90 miles away and brought the free man back to Tampa, where he would be safe and secure the next day when the verdict was announced. Similar stories of this nature could be duplicated time and time again. And it was because of this man's clout as a journalist that even the courts knew that they could rely on him to in such manners.
Chester, what's the name of the book? Give us the name of the book again, and how can we get a copy?
The title of the book is 50 Years of Struggle for Freedom by Edward Daniel Davis. It was copyrighted in 1981. And, Preston, at this time, we are trying to figure ourselves how to get more copies because the publisher itself is out of business. It was published by Drake Publishing Company out of Orlando in 1981. But for the few copies that his widow has, we're trying to figure how we can do that. I even contacted the Library of Congress to try to get some answers about how do you reproduce a book that's out of print, but the publisher is going under. So,
Let me remind our listeners that they're listening to The Gist of Freedom coming to them over blackhistoryblog.com. And should they have a question for our guest, Chester Sims, they can reach us at 347-324-5552. And you mentioned something, somebody being found on the highway by the troopers and whatnot. And I understand that you have, there in Florida, you've been instrumental in getting a highway and a bridge named after your uncle. Tell us about that process.
Okay, number one, I was not involved in that at all. That happened while he was still alive. The Florida legislature, and I actually have the proclamation here, passed a proclamation, flipping these pages, brother. It was called on June 2nd, 1990, Florida Senate Bill number 348 was passed, which names a portion of Highway number 441, the Edward Daniel Davis Senior Memorial Highway. This is the first time that a major highway has been named for an Afro-American in Orange County. If you work in any area of education and enjoy a salary equal to your counterpart, you should thank Ed Davis for filing the first suits in state and federal courts for equalization of salaries and facilities. If you take pride in being able to exercise your right to vote, thank Ed Davis, who was one of the founders of the Florida Voters League and is credited with registering more than 300,000 persons in the 6 years he served as president.
Boy, that was quite a chore.
Okay. Davis was chairman of the committee directing a 9-year effort to open the University of Florida to all citizens, regardless of race, creed, or color. Hundreds of letters and speeches are on hand to document the history and experiences and forces faced by blacks during the past 50 years. A book entitled Half-Century Struggle for Freedom in Florida, A Treatise on Overcoming second-class citizenship was written by Ed Davis. This pulsating account of the black man's struggle for equality earned him the Governor's Distinguished Floridian Award in 1986 from then-Governor Bob Graham. That was just the Florida Proclamation that mm-hmm. I read. So I was not, I fortunately was not involved in that. Not fortunately, I wasn't involved in that. But
okay.
Let me give you a short bio thing on my uncle here. It says in his bio part that you should read, and earns him Distinguished Citizen of Law. The man was an educator at both the collegiate and secondary levels, philanthropist, civil rights activist, businessman, author, husband, three times, twice widowed, widower, father, grandfather, devoted brother and uncle. He was listed in Who's Who in American Education, Who's Who in the South and Southwest, the Dictionary of International Biography, and Who's Who in America. He lived to be the oldest living alumnus and biggest benefactor to his undergraduate alma mater, helping untold numbers of students to get a college education.
What college did he teach at?
He taught at Bethune, at FAM, and it's so interesting when you read the case history for that University of Florida integration suit, like I say, a battle which took 9 years, and he says very succinctly how this is a case that could have been handled in 6 months, but because of all the delaying tactics, it ended up being 6 months. Here's something that might pique your interest that he states. Florida politicians are skilled in evading or sidestepping hot issues. Back in the 30s, I had a conference with the State Superintendent of Public Instruction, W.S. Cawthon, as we talked over the moral and legal ramifications of our equalization efforts. He let me have it squarely in the face. Said Cawthon, "You may be right on all grounds, Ed, but if I were to make any move in that direction," we're talking about that whole equalization thing now, "it would be political suicide, and frankly, some redneck would blow my head off through that window. I think that the only way that you will gain your objectives is through the courts, the federal courts. Those judges are appointed for life." And he talks about how that was a direct quote from the superintendent of education. He talks about me. See, the way that this man and Mr. Moore were able to, well, Mr. Moore didn't stay alive, but the reason Uncle Bubba was able to stay alive is he was creating a paper trail. I have his letters where he was writing to every president, all of the attorneys generals, all senators, representatives, and he was creating a paper trail. And I shudder to think this was when the man had, we didn't have nothing like a computer, and he was turning out all of these documents. He must have had two full-time secretaries because, you know, God knows what they would have done had they had a computer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but he talks about how in meeting with the governors, he says, the members of the Board of Control voiced the same sentiments as Mr. Cawthon, and when a committee of black citizens appeared before them with the same plea, they described the question as political dynamite. They said, "We will certainly admit blacks," we're talking about, "into schools of higher education as soon as the court tells us." He says, "We set up conferences with the following governors in our campaigns for full citizenship: Governors Holland, Governors Warren, Collins, and Burns. All of them gave the committee a polite hearing. None made definite commitments. Governor Warren was the more amusing of the group. He promised to look into all of the matters presented and did absolutely nothing. Governor Burns was the most volatile. He showed gross insensibility in telling a black representative group that he had appointed a black, a Mr. Dyson of West Palm Beach, to the Board of Control, but had instructed him that he was to be involved only in the business and not the social part of the board's program. During the educational equalization struggle, the Florida State Teachers Association had the support of the black institutions of higher education. Just to share a couple of what he calls how inane and stupid segregation was.
Chester.
Yes,
yeah, no,
yes,
before
sir.
You continue, because we're about out of time, I'm really intrigued by the screenplay that you're developing. Are you needing help with that? Do you have the financing? And how will people get in touch with you if they want to be involved in assisting you in getting that screenplay to the silver screen?
Number one, actually, no, we do not have all the financing yet. That's where what I have done is I have completed it, the screenplay. I submitted it to an agent, to my agent, actually, who thought it was worthy of going forward, and several friends whom I trust. It sort of took a back seat to our efforts to get him into the Hall of Fame first, and then as that is completed, hopefully within the next 2 months, then we're back on track to try to get this thing off the ground, Preston. And right now, the contact that I have is simply, you know, through my email address here. As I said, there are a number of persons from different walks of life who have read it. And as a matter of fact, my dad, who died 2 years ago at age 100, in perfect health, in his right mind, both long and short-term memory, read my screenplay in 45 minutes and said to me, "Boy, everything in there is true." That, to me, was like winning an Oscar, okay?
Do you mind giving out your email address?
Not at all. It's lowercase C-A-S, then two capital I's, as in Roman numeral 2.
Okay.
And then the numbers 1-6. And that's at sbcglobal.com. Again, that's C-A-S, the second, 16, at sbcglobal.com. I know you're running out of time. A couple quick tidbits I'd like to share with you.
Okay. One other, before you do that, Chester, are you on Facebook?
Yes, I am.
Are you on Facebook? Okay, and people can contact you there?
Yes, they can. And
okay.
I'm also on IMDb, because I'm a screen actor as well. So I can be looked up on IMDb.
Okay, go ahead and give us those couple of those tidbits right quick.
Oh, okay. There was a lady who was alive a couple of years ago who used to work for Uncle Bubba that told Daniel and I that he actually infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan. That made the top of my head blow off. I'm like, excuse me? And it's not like he walked in the office and said, "Hey, y'all, I'm here." No, but he was able to manage to do that through a paper campaign, and that's how he was able to find out who all the members were, when the meetings were, where they were, blah, blah, blah. And therefore, and by the time they discovered who he was, it was too late. He had all the info. That's one tidbit.
Okay.
He talks about that principle, being on the beach. In Florida in this time, the most common sign was no niggers, no Jews, and no dogs. Okay? So
okay.
He talks about this principal, Gibb, being on the beach in Tampa, and a white cop comes along and tells him to get his black ass off the beach. So this little white girl standing nearby with her puppy, because her puppy was black, walks up to the officer and asks him, "Can I stay on the beach with my puppy?" And the officer, of course, tells her, "Yeah, you and your puppy could stay, but the black man had to leave." He talks about the superintendent of education in Tampa, who had a secretary who not only herself would not address black folks as Mr. and Mrs., She refused to let black people refer to other black people as Mr. and Mrs. in her presence.
Mm-hmm.
How stupid is that shit? And it's ironic, Preston, that all of this happened within a stone's throw in 1912 of where Trayvon Martin lost his life, and not over there in Jacksonville, this kid, for supposedly music too loud. There's something in that area of Florida that breeds the most vile hatred you can ever imagine, and we need to address that.
Okay. Was his widow ever going to call in and contact us? Is she on?
Yes, Lerone, are you here? Hey, as I said to you in my email, I invited them to join us. I gave them the number, and they didn't. They've been on the other 2 hours we did with Byron Saunders. But I guess they didn't join us today, Preston.
Okay.
I do appreciate your time. And the last little anecdote, a man being forced to watch his son being handcuffed in the Suwannee River, and the child being given the option of either diving into the river himself, of course he's handcuffed and shackled with his feet and hands behind his back,
mm-hmm.
of being diving into the river or being shot and falling in, and the kid's only crime was he had sent a white girl a Christmas card.
Yeah, you mentioned Trayvon. Our listeners might be interested to know that we had a show on earlier featuring Trayvon's
that.
Parents on
yes.
at blackhistoryblog.com
yes.
With the attorney, Michelle Alexander, the
yes.
author of the new Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. And
I saw
they can
that.
Probably
yes.
pick that up on the archives, again, at blackhistoryblog.com. Chester, very, very interesting information that you put before us tonight, and I'm especially enlightened by the fact that there are heroes out there in the civil rights movement who are yet unsung, and I'm really looking forward to you're getting this screenplay out to get that story out. People bombed in their house on Christmas Day in 1951. A story that really needs to be out there, not only for the young people, but some of us older folk.
Yes.
Really have to understand what it is we have been up against today still. And I really appreciate your efforts and the work that you're doing to memorialize your uncle's activity there in Florida, and along with the Moors and others. But right now, we're going to have to say goodnight. I really appreciate, again, your being on tonight. And maybe we can get together in the future, and then you can give us an update.
So.
Yes, sir.
I certainly hope so. And I appreciate you having me on and taking the time with me to add this. Because, again, there are so many untold stories, and we all deserve a little more than what we get normally when people think of black history in this country.
Exactly, and that we can tell the story.
Yes.
As opposed to others.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I look forward to continued collaboration with you, my friend.
Great. Take care, Chester, and we'll talk again.
Thank you so very much.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Well, there you have it, folks. We were on with Chester Sams, who was telling us about his uncle, who was involved in the politics and civil rights movement of Florida for 50 years, from 1929 to 1979. Also mentioning some unsung heroes, the Moore couple who were bombed in their house in Florida in 1951. No one ever brought to justice on that. This was all coming to you over blackhistoryblog.com. Our producer is author and historian Leslie Gist. My name is Preston Washington. I've been your host, and I want to say good night. Good night. Thank you.
Thank you.